Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. At least 230 people have been killed by Hurricane Helene, which unleashed major devastation across North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, Tennessee, Georgia, and Florida. Hurricane Helene, a Category 4 hurricane, made landfall in Florida's Big Bend region last week. It was the deadliest mainland hurricane since Katrina in 2005. Well, Florida is now bracing for Hurricane Milton. That is projected to hit the southwest coast tomorrow evening. More than a million people have been ordered to evacuate. Tampa, Florida has not had a direct hit by a major hurricane since 1921, according to The Guardian. Here is NBC6 South Florida meteorologist John Morales becoming emotional as he updates viewers about Hurricane Milton.
It's just an incredible, incredible, incredible hurricane. It has dropped. It has dropped 50 millibars in 10 hours. I apologize. This is just horrific. Maximum sustained winds are 160 miles per hour, and It is just gaining strength in the Gulf of Mexico, where you can imagine the seas are just so incredibly, incredibly hot, record hot, as you might imagine. You know what's driving that. I don't need to tell you. Global warming, climate change leading to this and becoming an increasing threat for the Yucatan, including Merida and Progreso and other areas there. Let's see if I can show you the latest. There's the Cat 5 information. Winds 160 miles per hour. Moving east-southeast at 9 miles per hour. And on that track, you're going to notice that this system is going to come very, very close to the Yucatan. And the dirty side of this hurricane, folks, is on the right-hand side of its progress. So therefore, they're going to get the dirty side there. These communities, many of them, as you might imagine, many folks, you know, in that area have just the very basics, nothing else but that. So it's going to be very tough.
That was NBC6 South Florida meteorologist John Morales. A millibar is a unit of air pressure in the metric system. Tampa Mayor Jane Castor was on CNN last night telling residents to prepare and leave the evacuation zones. She said Hurricane Helene, which just left the Tampa Bay area a week ago, saw a 6-foot storm surge, which was devastating. She said this one is projected to be a direct hit with a 10 to 12 foot storm surge.
There's never been one like this. And this Helene was a wake-up call. This is literally catastrophic. And I can say without any dramatization whatsoever, if you choose to stay in one of those evacuation areas, you're going to die.
Wow. I mean, that is an incredibly blunt message. And I know you have a lot of experience dealing with these storms. You don't say something like that lightly, Mayor.
I've never said that. And 10 to 12 foot surge. I mean, if this takes a jog to the south, that's going to save us from the storm surge. But it stays on the track that it's projected to be on right now. Or if it goes a bit north, would be even worse. Some of the predictions are saying that Pinellas County to the south of us, the entire county is going to be underwater. So this is something that I have never seen in my life. And I can tell you that anyone who was born and raised in the Tampa Bay area has never seen anything like this before. People need to get out.
And your message is just, this isn't survivable.
This, if we have that predicted storm surge, it is not survivable.
That was Tampa Bay Mayor Jane Castor on CNN last night. Record hot sea surface temperatures in the area of the Gulf of Mexico where Milton formed were made up to 400 to 800 times more likely by climate change, according to hurricane scientist Jeff Masters and meteorologist Bob Henson. Whenever we do these devastating shows about the climate crisis, I think about a passage from climate scientists at Kimberly Nicholas's book, Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World. She writes, quote, "This book is a guide to how to live through what I think is the most riveting, challenging, terrifying, important, and meaningful time to be alive. The most essential lesson I take away from the thousands of scientific studies I've read and the 50 plus I've written is that people alive right now are living through the decade that will define the future for both humanity and life on Earth," end quote. Kimberly Nicholas is senior lecturer in sustainability science at Lund University in Sweden, and I really hope you can read her amazing book, Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World. We had Kimberly on to talk about her book, and you can find a link at kalw.org, click news, and then your call. Hi, Kimberly. Thank you so much for joining us again. Hi, do we have Kimberly? I believe she's there. Well, as we get Kimberly, I want to read another passage from her book because I think about it almost every time we do a show about climate. It's such a beautiful but intense, I will say, book. She writes about how we have to take action on climate by the year 2030. In order to deal with this crisis. And I think she explains it in such a powerful way. She writes, "If humanity continues to fail to make a rapid transition from dirty to clean energy, or if we make a half-hearted transition and are unlucky with how the planet responds to climate pollution, we might well experience warming of about 4 degrees by the year 2100. We have to take drastic, drastic measures by the year 2030, and then again by the year 2040. And I just wish that this was getting a lot more attention in this presidential cycle, because the next president is going to determine whether or not we take that action by the year 2030. And Kimberly Nicholas lays it out just so powerfully in her book, Under the Sky We Make. And I believe we have her now. Hi, are you there, Kimberly?
Hi, Rose. Yes, I'm here. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Kimberly. I have to say, I think about your book every time we do a show about the climate crisis, because I think you lay it out in such an incredible way. To think about the fact that those of us who are alive right now are living through the decade that will define the future. Can you just talk about that, given what we're seeing? I mean, what we've already seen in so many parts of the world, and now what we're tragically about to see happen in Florida.
Yes, it's really hard to get our minds around sometimes as we go about our everyday lives and get to work and get kids to school. But we really are the most critical people who have ever lived. And the reason for that is that we are the last stewards of humanity's remaining carbon budget. There's a fixed amount of carbon that humans can release into the atmosphere and stay within the agreed upon limits to stop global warming. And we're very, very close to those limits right now. So we're the ones who really will be very decisive in how quickly we make this transition happen. And that has just profound implications for the next thousands and thousands of years on Earth, for everyone alive now and for hundreds of future generations.
Talk about why the year 2030 is so important.
2030 is so important that I actually dedicated my book, Under the Sky We Make, to the year 2030. And I said, I hope we do right by you. To me, this is such a critical deadline because it's really our last best chance to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. humans will stop warming the climate once we stop burning fossil fuels and stop destroying nature. It's pretty simple. Once we stop releasing carbon to the atmosphere and are serious about declining other greenhouse gases, we will stabilize the climate and stop warming. So how fast we're able to do those two things, get off of fossil fuels and stop destroying nature, will determine the temperature increase. And that is what's driving so many impacts, including the extreme weather and climate disasters that we're seeing, like with Hurricane Helene. So 2030 is very soon, but we know from science that we need to cut emissions almost in half in order to be on track to meet the most ambitious stabilization goals that will lead for the best future for humanity. Basically, every year we delay makes the future job harder and means more avoidable suffering will be baked into the climate system, and that's not what we want.
You write, to stabilize the climate at any temperature, we have to completely stop adding carbon to the atmosphere, real zero. Can you tell us, you know, after the election, Kimberly, I really want to do maybe 1 or 2 weeks of just climate science 101. So what does it mean to stabilize the climate?
Yes, I would love to hear you do climate science 101. I have a haiku of climate science 101, which is, it's warming, it's us, we're sure, it's bad, we can fix it. That's what climate science boils down to from thousands of studies. And to stabilize the climate means that we have stopped adding carbon to the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide is a very, very long-lived greenhouse gas. It can contribute to warming for thousands of years. So it's essentially forever. And that's why it's so important that we focus on stopping adding that carbon to the atmosphere. Once we do that, we will be able to stop warming. And that's kind of the first step. We've done a lot of harm to the climate, but when you're in a hole, the first rule is stop digging. So the equivalent there is stop adding carbon to the atmosphere, which will let the temperature stabilize and let us start even maybe undoing some of the harm that we've done to the climate.
You write that if we can cut global carbon emissions about in half by the year 2030 and zero around 2040, we have a 2 in 3 chance to stabilize warming around 1.5 degrees Celsius. If we cut global CO2 emissions about 25% by 2030 and zero by 2070, we have a 66% chance of stabilizing the climate around 2 degrees Celsius, which is the upper limit of the Paris Agreement temperature goal. So again, I think it's so important to spend a lot of time really talking about how what we do now will determine where we're going, but why this 2030 deadline is so crucial.
Absolutely. I mean, we unfortunately have inherited a climate that is in trouble, and we've missed a lot of the best opportunities, which would have been, of course, in the past, to start being more serious about emissions reductions. But as the saying goes, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best is today. So any efforts that we make to reduce and eventually eliminate climate pollution is really, really going to pay off. And starting with a strong focus on cutting in half, so not going for, you know, very minor low-hanging fruit here and there, but really taking a serious approach and planning for zero. I think that's really important, because for a long time, the focus was on just not increasing emissions. And we, for a long time now, have known that's not going to be good enough. The climate will not stabilize if we kept today's emissions steady and didn't increase them, we would still continue warming. So the emissions themselves, our climate pollution from burning coal, oil, and gas has to actually go to zero in order for us to stop warming.
How should we think about this given where we are right now? I'm reading a headline from NASA Earth Observatory from March. Emissions from fossil fuels continue to rise. Carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuels rose again last year, reaching record levels. So given that we're reaching record levels and not pulling back, given everything that you've laid out, how should we think about where we are right now?
Well, it doesn't make sense. And I think, you know, I hear the cognitive dissonance in your voice, and I think that's appropriate, because it really is a case where human society and economy has not caught up with physical reality. And the faster we can align those, the better off we're all going to be. I think to make that transition actually happen, we need a lot of things to happen. But one of them is a clear commitment from leaders in government to make this transition away from fossil fuels, to actually stop burning the fossil fuels, which are the main source of the problem, and to make peace with nature so that we're actually living well with instead of fighting against nature, to have enough food and resources without destroying the limits of the planet.
If you'd like to join us, any thoughts about where we are right now with the climate media coverage of these issues? I hope you can read Kimberly Nicholas's book, Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World. It's just one of those books that you really carry with you. And I often just think about how she started the book, about how those of us on the planet right now are living through such an important time. We're living through the decade that will define the future of humanity and life on Earth, just based on what we're dealing with. And so if you have any questions or comments for Kimberly Nicholas, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. And I am not the only one that has been so affected by your book, Kimberly. We just got this email from Carol who says, as a result of reading Kimberly's book after your first interview with her, I just returned from my one annual trip. I used to take two trips abroad and one domestic trip annually. When I travel, I always send a travelogue to friends and family. This time, I ended my piece with the following. If you've noticed that I do fewer travelogues now, it's because I'm traveling less as one of my contributions to slow climate change for future generations. I am only one person, but it takes a village, and I feel a need to do my tiny part. While several friends responded to my travelogue, none of them mentioned anything about the last part, and I know most of the people who read it are traveling as much as they always have. Thank you, Kimberly, for your book. It has made a difference in my life, not just with travel. Wow, what a beautiful email, Carol. Thank you so much.
That is so wonderful to hear. I really appreciate that, Carol. And thank you, Rose, for sharing that. It's really encouraging. I know from experience that it often doesn't feel like the changes that we make a difference. And now that I've been living them long enough, I can say that it really is still worth doing. So, you know, it may be the case that Carol's friends didn't comment on the changes that she's made, but we know from research that leading by example is incredibly powerful and contagious. It's one of the most powerful ways that we can influence those around us. And it really is important to focus on high impact actions that cut a lot of emissions, like Carol has done. For those of us who fly, that is almost certainly the majority of our carbon footprint. So any flight you can avoid is a really high impact climate action. And talking about it is a high impact way to spread that action. And it might take time. It might not be that the first time your friends hear about it from you is the time that gets them to make a change, but it really does make a difference.
And I wonder what it's like for you. You moved from the United States to Sweden. I wonder what it's like for you from your vantage point overseas, watching what is happening. Let's just focus on the United States right now. Watching what's happening in the United States and this election. You know, just reading, I'm looking over the notes from when I read your book, and you write, you know, the science is settled. We need to act. We do not need more science to solve the climate crisis. The science is firmly settled. And yet you have someone like J.D. Vance at the vice presidential debate again saying, if you believe in climate change, which so many scientists say, we don't care what you believe. This is the science. And then, you know, Trump yesterday said he's never even heard of a hurricane category 5. And they say that the first thing they're going to do if they win is to drill, baby, drill. So we know that it's going to be absolutely devastating if Trump wins. It's going to be even worse than it was the first time around for the environment. So I just wonder, what is it like for you in another country watching what is happening in the U.S. right now?
It's extremely discouraging to have candidates for the highest political offices in the world saying things that are out of touch with science, that are not fact-based, and are out of touch with what most Americans believe and want. We know from large surveys from the Yale Center for Climate Communication that a large majority of Americans, more than two-thirds, plus of Americans are concerned or alarmed about climate change. Many Americans have already experienced the direct personal impact of climate change, including people who are preparing for or dealing with the aftermath of the hurricanes that are happening now, including my family, who was evacuated from their homes by wildfires in California, made worse and more extreme by human-caused climate change. So it's really disheartening and infuriating to have politicians that don't acknowledge the facts. But we know that we have the facts that we need. We have the majority of political will to act on them. It's one reason that voting is such a high impact climate action. In the climate guide that I've made, voting actually comes out as the number one climate action, far above consumer actions, even high impact actions like reducing flights. And the reason for that is that climate policies that get made by the politicians we elect have such a profound effect. There was a Canadian study that showed that you could effectively triple your personal carbon footprint overnight by voting for the Conservative Party there, which was the probably much less extreme, actually, than the policies you mentioned from Trump and Vance, but the weakest climate party in that election. So basically, voting for a party with poor climate policies, it increases emissions enormously. And that's why voting is so important. And looking at the climate scores of candidates and voting for candidates with a strong climate record is an enormously powerful climate action.
Well, thank you for that. We have a question from a listener who says, what about methane? You write about methane in the section of your book about land, livestock, and food.
Methane is extremely important. So it's the second most influential greenhouse gas behind carbon dioxide. Unlike CO2, it's pretty short-lived, something on the order of a decade rather than centuries to millennia. And that makes methane a really powerful lever, because as soon as we reduce methane, we feel the effects quite quickly. It takes a while for carbon to be naturally removed from the atmosphere through geological cycles, but methane is gone within about a decade. So that means that any cuts we can make to methane, which come from livestock, for example, from burning natural gas and from extracting natural gas, things that we can do in the short term that reduce those sources have a really, really powerful effect in reducing further warming.
Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I'm not a scientist, and you may correct me on some of these issues, but I'm not as optimistic as you might be about this getting done. Just a couple of things. I do follow the World Meteorological Organization and other entities on the internet, and a couple of things that I found that really interesting. One, China is the number one emitter of greenhouse gas emissions. I have no idea what the Chinese are doing in trying to cut their emissions. We're second, the United States. The 1.5 degrees increase in global temperature that the 2015 COP talked about wasn't supposed to be exceeded by 2030. But if I read this correctly just recently in the WMO, from July of 2023 to June of 2024, 1.5 degrees was exceeded. Now, I don't know if it was for the entire year, but it was exceeded. So the kind of things you're talking about in trying to get this under control by 2030, it would have to be dramatic, the changes that would have to be made. And I just don't know if the American people or the government is ready to do that. And when I say dramatic, I mean dramatic. You know this, and it would just be drastic. So I'm hopeful that it might happen, but I just don't see it going in the right direction.
Thank you, Greg. What are your thoughts, Kimberly?
Thank you, Greg. Unfortunately, you make a lot of very good points. First, on the China issue, you're correct. China is currently the largest greenhouse gas emitter globally, and that's been the case for about 20 years. Interestingly, China, with its very, very large population, has emitted about half of the total greenhouse gases that the U.S. has. So the U.S. is actually by far a larger emitter cumulatively in total, and that's what drives warming. So every country needs to play their part, including China. But the U.S., I think, has a special responsibility because we're only 5% of the world's population, and we've caused about 25% of the warming. That's far more than China in absolute terms, and it's far more on a per capita basis. It's also interesting to note, you can check out the Climate Action Tracker, which is a really good source for aligning policies, government policies, and holding governments accountable to their Paris Agreement targets. China's actually doing better than the U.S. there. So there's basically no major emitter that is currently on track. And as you point out, we have a very long way to go. But China has been making progress in reducing their emissions. So everybody needs to go faster and do more. But I think we'll have to do that through leadership and through encouraging others to follow rather than pointing fingers and trying to wait for others to go first, because that strategy just isn't working. Regarding the drasticness, unfortunately, that's true. We've waited too long for the easy options to be available. If we had started in the year 2000 reducing emissions, we could have reduced emissions about 3% a year and been on the track that we would have wanted. But now, with 2030 so darn close, we do have to make major and drastic cuts to stay on track. The sooner we can start, the better off we'll be, and we just can't wait any longer.
Before we let you go, Kimberly, since you're in Sweden, we know that what happens in the United States, what the president of the United States does on the climate, affects so many countries around the globe. I'm thinking about island nations, the global south, for example. Can you talk about that? Because that's also not getting the attention it deserves. What is at stake in this election around climate for countries that are already really, that have been devastated by the climate crisis?
Well, to be clear, there are countries, especially small island nations, as you mentioned, that are in danger of being literally wiped off the map by unchecked climate change. If we keep going with business as usual, if we don't make this transition away from fossil fuels happen fast and fairly, there are countries that will not make it into the future due to sea level rise, for example. And all of us will be facing much more serious impacts. So yes, I think a lot hangs in the balance of the U.S. presidential election. The whole world is watching. And I guess I would encourage people to get involved in their citizen capacity, not just in voting yourself, but in making sure others are registered to vote and supporting political parties and organizations, getting media attention like on this show, which I really appreciate, Rose, calling your reps directly. And one organization I think is doing really interesting work is the Environmental Voter Project. So they've identified 13 million environmentalists who don't vote in federal U.S. elections. All of the presidential elections for the last 30 years have been decided by a smaller margin. So actually activating existing voters who just are not active in managing to get to the polls and vote could be enough to swing the election in a really powerful way for climate. So finding a local group in your area, supporting a group like that is a really, really critical and powerful climate action, especially.
Kimberly Nicholas is Senior Lecturer in Sustainability Science at Lund University in Sweden and author of Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World. Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us again, and we'd love to have you back soon. Thanks for all of your great work.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And coming up after a break, we'll continue talking about the climate crisis in this country and what is at stake in the presidential election. This is Your Call's One Planet series. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series on Project 2025 by discussing the economy. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says Project 2025 and the House Republican agenda would increase poverty and the number of uninsured people. Project 2025 calls for tax increases on low and middle income people while cutting taxes for the wealthy and corporations. We hope you can join us tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about climate devastation and what it's going to take real action on these issues, what is at stake in the presidential election, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Joining us now is Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity. Hi, Brett. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you, Brett. We were just talking with Kimberly Nicholas there, who moved from the U.S. to Sweden. So she's got an interesting take on what's happening in the United States from the outside. And she talked about how voting is so important. What I love about the Center for Biological Diversity is that you go after all politicians, any politician who deserves criticism for not doing the right thing when it comes to the planet and the things that you all fight for at the Center for Biological Diversity. So I just wonder, Brett, what your thoughts are here. I was looking at the League of Conservation Environmental Scorecard last year, and these are the facts. I wish these facts were not the case, but they are. When you look at how politicians vote, according to the League, it's the Democrats overwhelmingly that get 80 to 100, and the Republicans who get 0 to about 35, maybe 41 in some cases. So what's your take? How do you read this?
Sure. And apologies in advance just for a tiny administrative thing. I'm here today representing the Center for Biological Diversity Action Fund. We are the political affiliate of the Center for Biological Diversity. And I have to just note that for sort of legal reasons, because nonprofits actually do not engage in electoral politics. So I apologize in advance. But I will note, in response to your question, that the Center for Biological Diversity Action Fund does have our own scorecard, where we actually try to tease out a little bit more of the differences among Democrats themselves, because they are not actually all equal on the environment. Right. But I do think there's a sad reality, and it wasn't always the case, that the current present-day Republican Party has become very much captured by the largest polluters in the United States and in the world, in fact, and has pushed a more and more extreme anti-environmental agenda basically every year. When the Clean Air Act was passed and the Endangered Species Act was passed back in the 70s, signed by Richard Nixon, approved almost unanimously, there was a much greater bipartisan support for the environment. And unfortunately, the Republican Party has shifted more and more every year towards this very, very extreme and ideological prism, basically to serve the largest polluters on the planet.
You know, I'm so glad that you brought this up, because I'm looking at your Senate scorecard here, and I love that you did this to look at where the Democrats actually voted. And I think this is really important for listeners to know. So at the very top of the list, these are the people who get 100% lifetime scores from the Center for Biological Diversity Action Fund: Elizabeth Warren, Edward Markey, Bernie Sanders. And then from there, you've got Cory Booker voting no on passage of the Fiscal Responsibility Act. I'll put a link on the website so you can read all of this. And then you've got Jeff Merkley, Richard Blumenthal, Chris Murphy, Mazie Hirono. And then at the very bottom of the list on the Democratic side, Joe Manchin, John Tester, Michael Bennett, Mark Kelly, Peter Welch, John Fetterman. Really important information. Brett, given the facts and what you just laid out there, why do you think that these issues are not getting more attention in the major media, given what is at stake here with this presidential election? And also, who controls the House and the Senate?
For sure. I mean, I think, you know, it's unfortunate that environmental issues often are sort of oversimplified in a lot of the sort of larger media narratives, where it's just, for example, whether or not Kamala Harris supports fracking or not, as opposed to the huge spectrum of environmental issues that these elections depend on, and the many, many ways that the environment affects ordinary people around the country all the time. And it's, you know, your clean air, clean water, protecting public lands, et cetera. And I think it is actually a disservice that they are not discussed more, because, in fact, many Americans do care deeply about environmental issues and want to understand the positions of candidates in a more robust way. Who controls the Senate, who controls the House, matters hugely when it comes to whether or not we can make additional progress on the climate crisis or just addressing any environmental challenge. And I think, you know, I'm not going to say there's any conspiracy here, but I do think that the larger media, you know, organizations tend to ignore these really important environmental issues because they don't create the right level of drama for what they perceive the viewer wants to see.
And yet, here we have these hurricanes getting front page news as they should. I mean, just to look at the devastation wrought by Hurricane Helene, and then now Florida is bracing for Hurricane Milton. 1 million people have been ordered to evacuate. And we played a clip earlier from Tampa Bay Mayor Jane Castor saying, if you don't leave, you could die. She said, I've never said anything like this. I've never seen anything like this. She said, this is not survivable.
Yeah, and what's amazing and just terrifying about Milton is the speed at which it went from a small tropical storm to a Category 5 monster, like the second fastest expansion of a hurricane in history. And, you know, there have been some meteorologists and a few people on television saying, you know, this is proof of climate change. This is what every climate model predicts with climate change, is these extraordinarily intensifying storms. You know, we focus on the disaster, but not the root cause. And you know, the reality is voting matters, because our future, this is what's in store for us if we don't really come to grips with the climate crisis. And far too many politicians are willing to only look at sort of catastrophe aspect of a hurricane, not ask the question, why are we facing two massive hurricanes in basically 2 weeks that just exploded in intensity? It's because of pollution and the climate crisis.
Going back to what you said about the Republican Party, what do you think explains this? The Republican Party is really an outlier on the world stage when it comes to the climate crisis. Why do you think they have moved so drastically in the wrong direction on this issue?
Well, I would, you know, there's not, I would say, any one source, but there is a reality that, and this gets back to why voting's important. We've had, you know, unfortunately, a conservative-dominated Supreme Court for many years, and they've gamed the system to ensure a supermajority of conservative justices who have effectively allowed very large corporations to basically buy elections with virtually no restrictions. They've gutted things like the corruption statutes to make it so that you can basically take a bribe if you're a politician. It's a lot harder to have good policy making when industries and special interests realize that one party has effectively become up for grabs. And you know that they can basically spend whatever it takes to ensure that their business model is protected. You know, Donald Trump said a few months back, you know, to the fossil fuel industry in a sort of a private dinner, "Give me $1 billion, you can do whatever you want if I win." And I think that's sort of telling of the transactional reality that the Republicans of the current sort of model believe in, which is, we want to be in power, we'll do what you want as long as you support us.
Well, if you'd like to join the conversation, we're speaking with Brett Hartle, Government Affairs Director with the Center for Biological Diversity Action Fund. This is the political affiliate of the center. They believe that the welfare of human beings is deeply linked to nature, to the existence in our world of a vast diversity of wild plants and animals. And I hope you take some time to go to their website just to see the really important work that they do. They work on such a wide range of issues trying to protect the incredible creatures in our world. So, for example, protecting horseshoe crabs, giant clams need your help. There's information here about a ban on trophy hunters' imports of famed Amboseli elephants. Flagstaff wolf removal violates the Endangered Species Act, according to conservations. rare desert wetland wildflower advances toward endangered species protection. So they do so much important work on pesticides, on plastic bags. You can check out their website, biologicaldiversity.org. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Dan writes, I appreciate everything your last guest, Kimberly, was saying, and I fully agree with her, but I think we're past the point of pretending that emissions will be cut in half by 2030. To name just a few, fossil fuel use is increasing. We don't have a feasible system of renewables in place to replace fossil fuels, and we have a political party that is either miles or hundreds of miles away from taking the necessary steps. It's depressing, but I think it's time to acknowledge mitigation and preparation should have equal, if not greater, focus than avoidance of the impending warmer weather. What are your thoughts on Dan's comment?
I would say a couple things. I think when it comes to addressing the climate crisis, we obviously have to do a lot of different things simultaneously, and we need to prepare for some of the global warming that is locked in. But I do think that the window has not closed yet when it comes to slashing fossil fuels. It's very difficult. We obviously have a very long road to get there, but you know, in this next election, just as an example, depending on, again, who takes power, this is a critical time when we do still have the opportunity to enact the right policies. And in our current system, we have two very clear choices, right? We've got Trump on the one hand, whose basic Project 2025 agenda is effectively drill everywhere, slash every environmental safeguard we can. And then we have Kamala Harris, who, you know, has not fully fleshed out her environmental program, and that's, you know, been a challenge, but has a record of being willing to hold polluters accountable from her time in California, from her record in the Senate. She had very strong votes and bills that she introduced. I think she will be a strong environmental president, and I do think that we can still take very significant action to slash fossil fuels. In California, you know, we saw an incredible amount of action this last session in the state house to address fossil fuels. Obviously, more has to be done, but the tide can turn, and you know, these hurricanes are a good wake up call, and hopefully, we continue to get people to appreciate how far we have to go. I certainly acknowledge it won't be easy, but I do think, if you look at even, for example, what did happen in Europe after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Europe made a very, very strong push to be like, you know, we need to get off of Russian fossil fuels and have massively slashed fossil fuel use. Expanded renewables are on a very good track at the moment. It's still difficult, but I do still have hope that we can actually solve these problems if we elect enough strong environmental leaders at all levels of government.
Well, let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Casey in San Francisco. Hi, Casey. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. I just want to say to the caller, I mean, to our guests, and just do a shout out, you know, to Barack Obama, who was on, I feel, the verge of dealing with the problem until Donald Trump went in and got Scott Pruitt in there and rolled back all the Obama environmental protections and regulations. So I don't know if we would still be in the hole, you know, as much as the hole that we seem to have gotten in, if those protections wasn't rolled back. And I'm hoping that with the Democrats in, I'm hoping that they kind of got a handle on being able to, like the guest said, hold on to some of those protections and then really implement those protections and really go forward, you know. So I just wanted to say that we don't want to forget we did have a president that was in there, very cognizant and aware, you know, of what this is. I think, as a matter of fact, his agenda was like 2028 or 29, so even a year before 2030. Thank you so much for
calling in. To your point, the New York Times looked at the Trump administration and what they did to environmental rules. This was in January 2021. They rolled back more than 100 environmental rules. So that's important. And then Brett, On yesterday's show, we had journalist Adam Fetterman on, and he has a whole piece about what Trump would do to public lands. And he talks about how the Trump administration wants to mine in so many places. And I think this is a key point, and this is what we're learning from Project 2025, that preparations for a second Trump administration have taken on a greater degree of professionalism. Policy ideas are being mapped out well in advance. A former Interior Department employee said, quote, "It is scary how well organized they are." So this second time around will be even worse than the first one.
That's exactly right. They learned a lot from sort of their ineptitude in the first round of Trump, and they don't want to do that again, which is why they've got this incredibly scary roadmap of everything they intend to do, whether it's drill and mine and privatize public lands, rapidly expand logging and all sorts of destructive activities, gut protections for endangered wildlife, got all of the Environmental Protection Agency's authorities, slashed that entire agency. The caller was correct to point out that, you know, Scott Pruitt and when Trump came in, they rolled back so many efforts. It took years to even get back to where we were at during the end of the Obama administration. The Biden administration had to spend a lot of time just dealing with the damage from Trump, and it cost us dearly in terms of time to address the climate crisis. And I'll just note too that, you know, the final piece, which is really important, is, you know, if Trump comes in again, we are going to see a judiciary, you know, federal courts from the Supreme Court on down, that is totally transformed, and they will sit there for decades to come trying to block environmental and climate progress. So, you know, yeah, voting matters. Voting has consequences. It's not, you know, just who's president. It's who's running every federal agency, all of these court seats that are really critical. Again, we can solve these critical problems, but we've got to, you know, frankly, win the election and get the right people into office.
Well, and Casey, to your point about rolling back some Obama policies, Aaron Rupar, who writes the Public Notice newsletter, wrote that during his first year in office, Trump rolled back Obama-era flood standards for infrastructure projects, which would have required that roads and bridges are designed to cope with rising sea levels and other climate change impacts. Revoking Obama's executive order before it could take effect, Trump boasted, quote, "We're going to get infrastructure built quickly, inexpensively, very quickly. I mean, this is what he's always saying these days. And right now he's lying about FEMA using emergency funds for migrants. And this is getting a lot of attention. It is having such a huge impact on people who actually need help on the ground. And I just want to play a quick clip that Trump recently just said. And again, we have to do this because this is the guy running for president. And because of the Electoral College, anything can happen. Here is Trump saying he has never heard of the term Category 5 hurricane.
I'm not sure that I've ever even heard of a Category 5. I knew it existed. And I've seen some Category 4s. You don't even see them that much. But a Category 5 is something that I don't know that I've ever even heard the term. Other than I know it, it's there.
We should also say that there's a lot of talk about whether FEMA has the resources it needs. And Newsweek just published a list of Republicans who voted against FEMA funding before Helene hit. And one of those Republicans is Florida Representative Matt Gaetz. There's a huge list of Republicans on the House side. And then on the Senate side, when you think about the devastation people are dealing with right now, Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee voted against FEMA funding. I'm just looking for others who got hit. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina. I mean, the list is pretty long on the Republican side. Brett, given that we are just 3 weeks out, a little more than 3 weeks from the election, can you just talk more about what is at stake here and what you would like to see in the remaining weeks, given that these hurricanes are getting headline news? But is there a connection between the hurricanes, the climate crisis, and then what is at stake in this election?
Sure. Yeah. I think, in my view, almost all of it's deeply connected. I'll try to start from a good point. You know, Project 2025 says they also want to privatize and cut the NOAA weather forecasting agency and services, which is the thing that actually lets us know where hurricanes are coming from. Project 2025 says that we should effectively unwind FEMA and the National Flood Insurance Program and privatize it or turn it over to the states. So basically neutering FEMA's ability to respond to catastrophes. And when it comes to disaster relief, again, there's this, you know, very ideological and cruel view of many Republicans, which is, we don't have to vote for this. We don't have to fund it. It's never going to harm us. Or, you know, they profess their concern about the national debt, even though the things that they actually push expand the national debt. But it is all connected to a very, very extreme ideology that basically says, you know, at its core, we don't really care about the well-being of our most vulnerable citizens in any form. And so we see it playing out with the hurricane, where so many Republicans are politicizing it, spreading lies, spreading misinformation. You have Governor DeSantis saying he won't even take the president's phone call. And it's all out of this very divisive, cruel hatred, really. And it's sad. It's not a good state of affairs. And it really does come from the top. It comes from the way Donald Trump sort of runs his campaign and what he has done to the Republican Party, which is everything is a political war with winners and losers. And as long as their side wins, who cares what the consequences are? So when we do have an election like this one, where everything is on the ballot when it comes to the rights of women and abortion and healthcare and the climate crisis and our sort of ability to take care of each other as citizens, that there's really a very clear choice. And one side, you've got Kamala Harris and she's promoting an agenda that I think really will help people, will address the environment and the climate crisis. And then you've got the cruelty of Donald Trump. And we see it playing out very much with these two hurricanes where, yeah, one side is willing to put politics aside because we need to help people. And the other side wants to score points for short-term political gain.
Brett Hartle is Government Affairs Director at the Center for Biological Diversity Action Fund. That's the political affiliate of the CBD. They believe that the welfare of human beings is deeply linked to nature, to the existence in our world of a vast diversity of wild animals and plants. Brett, thank you for your work and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show, and thank you so much for joining us. I hope you can join us tomorrow. We will talk about economic plans of Project 2025 and House Republicans. This is your call.